Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to the New Yorker Poetry Podcast. I'm Kevin Young, poetry editor of the New Yorker magazine. On this program, we ask poets to choose a poem for the New Yorker archive to read and discuss, along with one of their own poems that's been published in the magazine. My guest today is Campbell McGrath, who's published nearly a dozen collections of poetry and whose honors include fellowships from United States Artists, the Library of Congress, the Guggenheim Foundation, and the MacArthur Foundation. Thanks so much for being here.
Well, it's my pleasure, needless to say.
So the poem you've selected is Realism by Czesław Miłosz. Tell us, what in particular drew you to this poem as you're browsing through the archive?
Well, you know, I didn't even need to browse through the archives. I remember this poem from The New Yorker even before it becoming, you know, a poem in his books that I read again and again and again.
All right, let's hear it. This is Campbell McGrath reading Realism by Czesław Miłosz, translated from the Polish by the author and Robert Haas.
Realism. We are not so badly off if we can admire Dutch painting. For that means we shrug off what we have been told for 100, 200 years. Though we lost much of our previous confidence, now we agree that those trees outside the window, which probably exist, only pretend to greenness and treeness, and that the language loses when it tries to cope with clusters of molecules. And yet this here, a jar, a tin plate, a half-peeled lemon, walnuts, a loaf of bread, last, and so strongly it is hard not to believe in their lastingness. And thus abstract art is brought to shame, even if we do not deserve any other. Therefore, I enter those landscapes under a cloudy sky from which a ray shoots out, and in the middle of dark plains a spot of brightness glows, or the shore with huts, boats, and, on yellowish ice, tiny figures skating. All this is here eternally, just because once it was. Splendor, certainly incomprehensible, touches a cracked wall, a refuse heap, the floor of an inn, jerkins of the rustics, a broom, and two fish bleeding on a board. Rejoice! Give thanks! I raised my voice to join them in their choral singing, amid their ruffles, collets, and silk skirts. One of them already, who vanished long ago, and our song soared up like smoke from a censer.
That was Realism by Czesław Miłosz, translated by the author and Robert Haas, published in the April 11th, 1994 issue of the magazine. So I love that reading, but I also know why you admire this poem. It seems to me that all the nuss, it talks about the lastingness, the greenness, the treeness. I can see that in your work, A, and B, also it's a kind of primer on what poetry does, isn't it?
It's just a poem that is so intelligent in so many different ways and isn't making a big deal out of its intelligence, isn't even trying to prove anything to us except, you know, running through this set of thoughts inspired by looking at some old Dutch still life or still lives and then suddenly saying, well, what does it mean that this version of art versus, you know, I love in the middle where he comes to abstract art is brought to shame. Even though we deserve no other, that actually I almost stopped it. You know, even in the reading of it, I almost laughed aloud at that line. Like,
right. There's a humor in the poem. His humor sometimes is, well, it's often understated. How would you describe it?
I think understated. Yeah, he's not. I mean, I can think of so many of his poems, and you don't laugh out loud.
I mean, in fact, this one, you know, somehow.
I mean, even just that, you know, like the jerkins of the rustics. I mean,
that's a great line.
I feel sure they were laughing, him and Robert Haas, in the translation. Like, you know, that's the tone. You know, in which you're using the language of that time, but you're also kind of realizing how there's just a comedy in those words to us nowadays.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and what about translation? Do you think about it yourself, or do you do translations? How do you approach this, because I think that is another thing that, you know, it's a beautiful partnership between Milos and Haas through, you know, many decades. They translated, Haas has spoken so well about that process for him and discovering that connection.
I wish Robert Haas would translate my poems into Robert Haas poems. I mean, Milos was a crazy genius or whatever we want to call him, obviously. But, like, nonetheless, to have had Haas be your translator is a pretty amazing thing, because you definitely read the Milos poems and you hear Haas's voice as well, which is such an incredibly deep, grounded voice with all this...
That's so interesting.
Again, intelligence and imagism and... Yeah, I mean, because Haas's translations of haiku are just as brilliant, and they're crossing all these bounds.
Well, and I think the other thing I like, just to get back to this philosophical quality that you're talking about, is there's these thuses and therefores, which, again, kind of mark the poem's vintage or its thinking about vintage. But there's also a quality of if this, then that, that isn't... It's unexpected. You know, there's a lot of leaps between the therefore. You know, it's not, well, therefore I enter those landscapes. Well, not necessarily, but sure, you do, you know.
Yeah.
And thus abstract art is brought to shame. There's a mind at work behind that.
Absolutely. That's what comes to me, you know, in this poem is like, wow, what a mind. I mean, it's what you feel in Elizabeth Bishop's poems is like, wow, there's that mind again. I mean, like three sentences, I think I could pass, you know, at random, say, that's Elizabeth Bishop's mind. It's so smart, has a particular way of examining and addressing the world. Milos is different but deeply recognizable as a person who moves through the world as they write, both imagistically, there is a world, he's setting it down, and always, though, the ideas and the thoughts that might occur, that have occurred, become part of the text. Even as he's exploring and depicting the world, he's also thinking it through, and they become interwoven on the page in this just breathtaking kind of way.
That's well put. In the beginning there, for that means we shrug off what we have been told for 100, 200 years. You know, you could almost stop there.
Right.
And then he says, though we lost much of our previous confidence. Okay, you know, that's yet another, wait, hold on. We had confidence, we lost it. And then he says, right, now we agree. Do we? You know, that those trees outside the window, which probably exist, only pretend to greenness and treeness. And that kind of quality of language, that he's saying the world is always, in a way, translated. And
yes,
that this yeah, art is itself a translation is really fascinating.
Yes. I mean, you know, it's a poem about visual art. Theoretically, it's just about visual art. Obviously, always... A poet, when writing about visual art, is using that as also a metaphor for literary art, for poetry. It's like saying, yeah, look, I'm going to look at Dutch paintings. I know those are 200, 300 years old, and that's now antiquated. We don't do that anymore. You know, we're so modern, we make modern art. And yet, what the heck? Look at this. I mean, how can I not see it and feel like our art is brought to shame by the perfection of that art?
Yeah.
Not that everything needs to be that still life.
Yes.
But like when you see it, you're like, but there's something about this, isn't there? That you just say there's something, it's incredible and brilliant and perfect in its attention to the world.
Mm-hmm.
I can feel that too when I look at a, you know, Motherwell painting some Jackson Pollock, say, but its notion of attention were different. I think for sure Milos is a more conservative art critic than I am.
Exactly.
I like all versions.
Exactly. If we only had Dutch art,
maybe. If we only had Dutch art, I'd say, well, what happened? I mean,
right. But he is saying, look here. I think poets are often saying, look at this overlooked thing. But he's also saying this wasn't once overlooked. And so that's an interesting collaboration. All this is here eternally just because once it was. That's a really interesting idea, which is that art is, of course, always wrestling with, is how do I capture this moment but also capture it forever?
It's, you know, and that, too, is a notion that artists would resist or deny now, you know, in our more cynical age. That's the Shakespearean notion, you know, so long as this. Hey, you're eternal if I write you in this poem, because art is eternal. Wow. I mean— Shakespeare believed that, and I guess the Dutch masters believe that too. Nowadays,
you don't believe it.
I don't, you know, I mean, I think it's all going underwater, and I don't
you
think...
You do live in Miami, so there is that, I mean, that notion behind right. apocalypse. Welcome it, you know, yeah. is that what you're saying?
I mean, as a species, we're not eternal, so how can anything we make be eternal? But, I mean, if there
what
is
eternal,
anything yeah. eternal that we as human beings do, I do believe it's art.
Okay. Well, and Milos is interesting because there is a part of this poem that I thought was very Catholic in the big C sense. I mean, it's also trying to think about the little C Catholic in some way. But he's also talking about a very specific kind of wonder. He calls it splendor, certainly incomprehensible. You know, that's a is that, that a very Catholic notion? Is that something you that strikes you here?
It might be. You know, I was thinking of it aesthetically. You know, I mean, there's nothing splendid about, you know, the fish being cut up on the board or the, you know, the half of a melon
right,
in
right.
those paintings,
yeah,
right? I mean,
right,
the thing itself,
right.
you'd be like, it's a half a melon, whatever. I don't, you know, get it away, perhaps you'd say. It's the depiction of it that actually makes it better than the reality.
I see.
I mean, in other words, if you were
it's
actually—
It's not inherent in the object.
I don't know. I mean, that's what I think this questions that. Because, like, if you mm-hmm. were given the tray of objects— that this Dutch master is going to depict, like a you know a dead grouse and a chopped up fish and a melon and a lemon, you
Jerkins.
Might say, you might say no, thank you.
Yeah.
And yet, when you look at it,
yeah.
you're, as you say, you know, you're drawn in. Suddenly, I'm in that landscape just with those little tiny ice skaters.
Yeah,
you know,
a yellowish eyes, which is a great
just
detail.
Drawn out there because it's the that person's attention to that world is so convincing that I feel as if I can enter it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's saying that's something that, like, even if you were to say, I love Jackson Pollock, it doesn't create a world that invites me into it. I'm responding to it some different way. I think that would have been what Milos might have said.
Interesting. Here
right.
he's saying, rejoice, give thanks. And then he says, one of them already who vanished long ago. He joins this lostness. And I think that, but he's also talking about lastingness. And I think we, you know, this is something I end up writing about a lot is we're more interested in what's gone than what lasts sometimes, you know, and maybe that's the difference.
Yes. I mean, and also, again, Miłosz's whole life was colorized by the notion of Europeanness. I mean, that, you know, he came from a part of Europe that was distinctly European and yet at the edges. He was at the edges of European culture. That's how he always felt himself, you know, from that kind of Lithuanian, Ukrainian, Polish borderland. Like, we've been part of Europe a long time, and yet we've always been an outskirt of Europe. We're not Paris. We're not, you know, he always knew intellectually he is of Western civilization, whatever that means, and the Catholic Church even, which is that for millennia, the centerpiece of that notion. And yet then he ended up living the second half of his life in Berkeley at the far other edge of Western civilization, looking over another ocean and kind of therefore I think was constantly attentive to, well, what is this thing that he knew he really had come from and yet could now look back on. And so when you see the Dutch masters, well, they knew what it was. That's, you know, whatever Western civilization
so
is, that's it.
Yeah, so he feels like he's grabbing hold of solid thing. But then he ends, and our song soared up like smoke from a censer. And that reaches back into ritual and
it does
the church.
It really does. It makes it spiritual, and it also makes that we is that we, you know, Miłosz and every other artist who's ever existed, all of us as human beings who are attending to the moment, whatever it might be.
Or
it's
is
a
it
really
the
big
Western?
We.
I mean, and that's the question I think the poem thinks about a little bit is can everyone make that leap? Or should one?
Yeah.
And, you know, your poem that we're going to look at in a minute, it goes internal where this poem goes external. But I also, I wonder if that smoke isn't more fragile than Milos even intends it to be. I mean, the smoke goes away, right?
Yes. Again, I think he was also aware that he was writing at the end of a tradition. I mean, you know, the Catholic Church being central to his worldview, and he was even buried in a church in Krakow. But you know, if he'd lived even 20 years, 15 years longer, I wonder what his, you know, the church that I'm sure he had some skepticism about has itself been kind of reduced in the way that, you know, has been reimagined now through this whole different lens of what it has been, you know. I mean, I'm...
Did you grow up Catholic?
I didn't really. My parents, you know, grew up Catholic, Irish Catholics. They had kind of... were suspicious of it by the time I was brought up. I was baptized, and then I, you know, only when I visited family members, my aunt's a nun, and so the family.
You could have been Pope. I mean, I was baptized Catholic too, so I could be Pope one day.
See,
these there's still a chance.
These are valuable credentials. It's like having an EU passport.
Well, it's more like having a British passport. That That's Brexit is coming.
Yeah, you're right.
Now, in the November 3rd, 2003 issue of the magazine, The New Yorker printed your poem, The Human Heart, which we'll hear you read in a moment. Is there anything you'd like us to know about this poem? Anything that comes to mind?
It's not exactly representative of my poems. If you read my, selected poems, there's not too many that look like this poem. I stumbled into this poem, and it has remained very meaningful to me.
Here's Campbell McGrath reading his poem, The Human Heart.
The human heart. We construct it from tin and ambergris and clay, ochre, graph paper, a funnel of ghosts, whirlpool in a downspout full of midsummer rain. It is, for all its freedom and obstinance, an artifact of human agency in its maverick intricacy, its chaos reflected in earthly circumstance, its appetites mirrored by a hungry world, like the lights of the casino in the coyote's eye. Old as the odor of almonds in the hills around Solano, filigreed and chancelled with flavor of blood oranges, fashioned from moonlight, yarn, nacre, cordite, shaped and assembled valve by valve, flange by flange, and finished with the carnal fire of interstellar dust. We build the human heart and lock it in its chest and hope that what we have made can save us.
That was The Human Heart by Campbell McGrath.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So I'm struck by the form as well. When you say it doesn't look like this, do you mean the rhyme that creeps in? The what I love about it is just when you think you know how it's going to exactly rhyme, I feel like it shifts on us a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I love rhyme. I mean, you like rhyme too.
It's a confession. Let's confess.
Yeah, that. I mean,
rhyme is okay.
Right. I feel bad for the weird corner rhyme has been sent to stand in now by poets. I'm like. Like if you ask graduate students to write a rhyme poem, they really think that they're being tormented in a way. I'm like, no, come on, this isn't. I mean, rhyme is so creative. I mean,
Because rhyme, let's face it, rhyme was done really badly for a while. I mean, sure. I think if you read late 19th century poems in the American, scene and read broadly, you come away saying maybe we should have disposed of rhyme.
Absolutely. No, I completely agree. That's why I myself seldom really do it.
But, we can mark rhyme's return in some way. And I think we have, slam poetry to thank for that and hip-hop and many other rhymes that thought about internal rhyme and thought about different kinds of rhyme than the kinds of end rhyme that, that had kind of dominated for, it felt like eons.
Absolutely. Then that got blown up with its antithesis with like modernism. Like, not only are we not going to rhyme, you don't even know what I'm talking about. Like, okay, then that was another alienating gesture. And,
poets get in their own way, I suppose.
The few people who had stuck with poetry as readers said, well, now I'm really done. It doesn't rhyme. And I don't understand it. And even if it does rhyme, it's, greeting card rhyme. So, greeting card rhyme is of no value to us.
Right. See, I was thinking you were going to say that your other poems don't do this kind of thing where they think about this big idea, but they all do in some way. And here you are you know, addressing or bringing this much like Milos, but then also to this piece of anatomy that, of course, is more than that. It is ambergris and clay, ochre. It is maverick intricacy. It is the lights of the casino and the coyote's eye, a great line. What brought you to do that? You said it was a little different.
I liked the notion of this poem going with the Milos poem, that they are both poems that are doing this gesture of thinking for a we, speaking for a we, which is, again, a gesture we're skeptical of in this modern age, and I think rightfully so. But this is a poem where I felt like, no, I feel something to be true, and I just want to say that. I think this is a thing. You know, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong, whatever, I don't mind. But I'm so skeptical of things, and maybe cynical too, that I seldom, you know, posit a thing as definitely no. I'll probably undercut it and offer the alternative in my poem as well.
Sure.
It's like, no, I think this thing is true, that the heart isn't something we're given. We build it. We think of, you know, I mean, even, nah, I don't mean biologically, although we do build our own heart biologically too, I suppose, anatomically, but so many things that we talk about, like community, the heart, compassion, these are not like passive things that we receive. These are things we need to construct through active participation, engagement. Mm-hmm. And like, I guess at the certain moment when I wrote this poem, I was just startled to see, suddenly that came into shape in my mind, like, oh, it's this. You know, it was kind of an argument poem with people who felt differently. Like, no, you don't have to do that. It's just like, no, if you don't do it, then you are heartless, or then you are failing. Well, then I said, okay, so what does it mean we have to build the heart? Okay, that's an interesting thought.
Yeah, because you don't start there. You can't, and I don't think you could.
Yeah.
I think it's much stronger to say, here it is. It's built of these strange to each other elements. I think what's one of the functions of the rhyme in the poem is rhyme is always connecting these two ideas. And I feel that rhyme is saying these two things aren't just sounding alike, they are alike. You know, and you manage to by making the rhymes, let's call it strange, moonlight and cordite, they are full rhymes, but they feel very different. They're unexpected. And I think, you know, you've come pretty close to the orange, the difficulty of orange not rhyming with anything with flange there, you know?
Yeah, you're right about that. I don't think I was conscious of orange being the unrhymable word, but for, you know, I mean, because I could have changed the fruit, I suppose, you know, but I like.
No, but you like oranges.
I do like oranges and blood oranges too, because this is the heart we're talking about.
Yeah,
I think, you know,
you
have to be a little bloodier, you know. The fact that it's called a blood orange makes it, to me, a great thing to bring into the heart.
It's a great thing.
And cordite and moonlight, I agree. That's the most, you know, that's the most rhyming of opposites that therefore somehow makes you consider them as a pair, and they're so, you know, different at so many levels, and rhyme does do that. It pairs those two words, at least in your consideration for a moment, even if it moves forward.
Were you conscious of starting with the more slant of the rhymes and then moving into a fuller rhyme, or at least visually a fuller rhyme? You know, clay and rain and funnel and whirlpool are perhaps the least rhymey of the rhymes, and that's what starts us off. And then we get obstinance and circumstance, which don't necessarily rhyme in American English. And within that, agency and intricacy. These are all great words that I can't necessarily get into a poem. But here you have them paired up. And I was wondering how that works. Maybe another way to put it, this is how I, you know, would say it if I was talking to students, is how does that work in the poem?
Yeah. No, I think it's exactly true that the poem, I certainly wasn't consciously saying I will build this poem with this, you know, A-B-B-A rhyme scheme with these like kind of different length lines, but it showed up just in the musicality, let's say, of clay, funnel, whirlpool. And I'm like, oh, that's not even musicality. That's a kind of slant rhyme.
Mm-hmm.
And then I said, I like that, and I think that's an important part of this poem. And then as I got to the end, I said it really needs to, I think the rhyme needs to, especially in the last stanza, be what locks the poem down. So it has definitely moved in its last two stanzas towards something much closer to true rhyme.
Mm-hmm. And it's a truer for you sentiment, as you're saying. You're saying you're building this thing, right? It kind of mirrors the building that you're saying the human heart does. And here, you know, I would just point out something I really love. Dust and us, I mean, you know, great, amazing. But then there's also these slant rhymes, dust, heart, chest, assonance, consonants, I should say, which is to say the consonants are the same and this hard ending that ends with the softer us. Really lovely, I think.
Yeah, and in stanza three, We get World Casino Old Solano. And I remember one point saying, like, well, let's just call all four of those playing in the same, you know, sandbox.
Right.
Wait, didn't you kind of switch from ABBA to ABAB?
Yeah,
whatever.
I think you did.
Let's call them all. They're all talking to each other with an O, even if really that's actually switches the rhyme scheme.
I mean, I find this a lot when you talk to people about poetry is sometimes, you know, I'll ask people what a sonnet is, and they'll say letters, you know, like, this is the rhyme scheme, and they'll describe it. And I'll say, well, actually, I mean, what's the inner workings of a sonnet? You know, what does a sonnet do? You know, because it almost doesn't help you either as a reader or as a writer to sit down and say, I need to, you know, have this pattern. Instead, you have to say, oh, I'm writing love poems, and they're kind of short. They're kind of to the same beloved, you know, who may be abstract or there. And I need to find that form that does that. And there's the sonnet for you.
Right. No, I agree. The sonnet is an incredibly brilliant form because of its structure, not because of its rhyme scheme. In fact, unrhymed sonnets are just fine with me. It's that 8 and 6 or else the 4-4-4-2, which is, you know, however, both
the
versions
turns.
And the turns and the notion of its is it a call and response? Is it an answer and an amplification? You know, what any of those versions, and yet with the stricture of you can't. I mean, I am a maximalist, so then I, you know, if at line 13 I have more to say, I'll just blow it up and write 29 lines. But no.
Yeah, you got to get it in.
You got to fit the painting within the frame, and that's the lovely thing about sonnets. And this is not a sonnet, but it has essentially, you know, it's not too much bigger than a sonnet.
Right.
And it's basically the loveliness of forcing yourself to live within the limits of the canvas is, you know, because we don't have to, of course. We don't have to rhyme. We don't have to stop at 14 or 20 or 40 lines.
Right.
But to find your way to that restraint and understand how it helps enhancing by shaping and limiting the poem is great when it happens.
Yeah. So I want to talk about maximalism, which has come up for me a lot and thinking about it, but also thinking about, you know, your broader project, your selected poems that you recently had. And you've written a lot of books that think like books. You know, they're book-length poems, or they're poems that add up to a book. Even your first book, Capitalism, has that great, I mean, first of all, you know, realism, capitalism, you know, one would accuse you of having some isms in your work. But also there's this way in which you're trying to think about these big systems in these little ways.
I really believe in the book. I mean, most poets and many poets have the poem is the. And of course, it has to be. I mean,
I
mean, the line has to be the
sure.
line. Each line has to be a thing, and then each poem has to be a thing. But then, not all poets. The book is a thing, and it doesn't have to be. There are just collections. Hey, oh, that's 42 really nice poems.
Right.
I don't necessarily make the collective entity particularly important to me. The poem is the unit that matters, and without letting the poem somehow not matter, I still focus on the book. The book to me is really important. I think because I love books, and
yeah.
you know, that's where
that's
before
where
I love poems, I love books.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
So I mean, even when I feel like I have a lot of good poems here in my hands, I don't necessarily feel like it's a book.
Yeah,
until something happens that makes it be a book.
And did that happen with the selected?
The new one selected was really fun. To do.
Good.
You know, I'd been suspicious about it for
a long time.
Yeah. I mean, I remember discussing with you, how did you survive your new and selected, Kevin? And you did.
Mine was selected and uncollected.
So I decided I'll
put the new part off for a while.
You're absolutely right. But that made it new, by the way. And also, that's what I think a new and selected needs to be. It can't really just be the greatest hits album because we have all those songs, so we don't need to have them in a new configuration. Something has to make it a book. I thought it was a very brilliant turn to turn on its head the notion of having outtakes and saying, no, actually, by putting them in, it becomes new. You know, we've actually remixed it and it's become something different. That was very interesting.
Thank you.
You're welcome. My version was to put the new, which is, you know.
Of course.
So that, yeah, okay, well, you know, 4/5 of that book have come out of previous books. But then with the new, it's still, you know, you can still apprehend the whole body of work and see something different.
But then
I repackaged it too.
Yeah,
it wasn't
just so you put like prose poems together. I mean, tell us what you did.
Yeah, I mean,
for those who don't have it yet, because I know they'll run out and grab it.
Absolutely, for sure they will, because especially the audiobook, because you know you can be working out, listening to me read the poems.
Oh, did you read every poem?
Fall asleep Yeah. That's the whole amazing thing. It was really fun, too.
It was fun?
It was. I found it to be really fun.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, it was a couple days.
I read Brown,
in the
studio. And I was, you know.
You were ready to get out of there.
Well, it was exhausting, you know. Like, but I think you point to something else, too, that the poems live orally, hourly. They live aloud.
I think that they should. All writing partakes of the sentence, which is a great thing, but only, you know, and even a great, what we all understand to be a great novel, you don't necessarily need to hear aloud. I mean, it isn't enhancing the experience. It might be nothing wrong with it. The poem needs to kind of move from two-dimensional to three-dimensional when you hear it aloud. I mean, a good poem has that built into it, right? It's the text, it's the meaning, it's all the stuff we could talk about. And yet when you hear the language read, you're like, oh, there's this other thing. It takes on another shape or kind of reality in the world. That's great. So that was fun part of it too. And they were older poems for me too. So I was actually reliving them as I read them. Like, oh, I haven't read this poem aloud in a lot of years. It's like, I mean, it's going back 35 years, I think I said.
Wow.
A couple poems I wrote, you know, in college.
Yeah. So in fact, I saw, because I did my research on you, that your first poem in The New Yorker was 1989. Is that right?
Yeah. I was just out of graduate school. And on a whim, I sent a couple of poems to The New Yorker, and Alice Quinn was the poetry editor then, and I had just thought these were historical poems. It was two little poems she took, and she published them in the Thanksgiving issue because they're kind of – it's called What They Ate and What They Drank, and they're about pilgrims, early Americans in the American landscape and food.
Or early
usages.
Settlers, at least.
Settlers. I mean, you know, whatever. I don't – you know, it was based on some of those early colonial history books. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were little rhymed sonnet-esque poems, in fact. And
I love those poems.
She took them and put them – I was like, wow, that was very exciting.
So that was 30 years ago.
That was 30 years ago.
So you have a long relationship with The New Yorker, and I—that's
I'm
you could go
excited.
For Merwin. Merwin had a seven decades long, you know, relationship with The New Yorker. That blew me away when I realized that, and I started thinking about, like, you know, is that possible now that you can have this relationship across time with your work with one publication?
Well, I mean, you know, The New Yorker is it. I mean, there's no. I mean. You know, there's no other, at least, highly visible publication. And but I mean, even when The New Yorker changes poetry editors, as it has with your arrival, you know, a year or two ago, and, you know, Paul Muldoon, and it's a more of an evolution, right? Whereas Poetry Magazine has been basically recreated really dramatically several times with its change in because it's a real change in the philosophy, not just the editor choosing different poems. Whereas The New Yorker has a vision of poetry that has carried on for all the very real differences.
Right. Well, and that's what I think is interesting about Merwin specifically, is he went through many changes, and yet there was this place where he could enact those changes. And obviously, those changes are happening in real time, which is to say we're publishing the poems he's writing for The Lice as that's happening, or Carrier of Ladders, or the poems that are changing for him.
Yeah.
There's a stable place that can render them public.
And I think Bishop did that too, you know, in, you know, a couple of generations, shifted a little bit earlier, you know, through the mid-century, 20th century, like, what percentage of her poems in The New Yorker? Maybe 50% sometimes, you know? I mean,
well, and she had one of those exclusive contracts, First Read, which, you know, one wishes still existed, both as a poet and as an editor, to be able to first see poems. And Plath, I think, had one of those.
It makes sense, like, with Bishop, though.
Yeah.
You know, because she, you know, it was only going to be 20 finished poems over a 10-year thing.
Well, and we read her correspondence with The New Yorkers, which I read long before I was, you know, here.
Right.
I was like, what a great correspondence. And it's sort of the dream of a literary connection, because I remember, and I'm sure you do too, when you would send poems out and there was no body, you know, like, you didn't know who that person was. They were just a masthead person.
Right.
And you would end up striking up these somewhat long, you know, soon it switched to email, but not very, you know, kind of recently.
Yeah.
And so I had a good, I don't know, 10 years or more where I was writing with people back and forth. And even the early days of email, you might not even meet them for a time.
Oh, no, absolutely.
And I mean, have we lost that a little?
Well, I mean, it changes. Like, I mean, you and I, Kevin, we couldn't have a first read contract with anybody because they'd have to read dozens and dozens of poems that we're writing. I mean, you know, which I'm, you know, maybe
don't envy.
That,
yeah.
Is that self-criticism? I don't know. I mean, you know, what can you say? We're producing poems. I think they're all good poems, by the way. But, you know,
sure.
I don't think anyone at The New Yorker or elsewhere needs to read every single one of them and labor over making some decisions, not in the least.
Sure.
So, but, you know, things change or whatever.
Yeah, sure.
You know what? I have that relationship with my editor, Dan Halpern. I mean, I have it not at the level of a magazine, but at the level of the book, which, as I've already said, is a thing I really value. I mean, I've had a 25-year relationship with my editor, Dan Halpern. And before that, he was my teacher. So, you know, I have that relationship with him in terms of the books, thinking about the books, where the new books, talking about it. And in fact, The Human Heart, I mean, Dan doesn't, you know, read my work line by line and edit it very often anymore because, you know, it would be, makes little sense to you. But I remember distinctly when I submitted the book that The Human Heart was in, which is Pax Atomica. It was somewhere kind of in the middle of the manuscript. And Dan said, to me, that's the central poem. You know, that needs to go right. And I moved it right to the very front of the book. I said, if Dan says anything, I'm like quite sure it's true. And I immediately implement it.
Isn't that funny? When you read like manuscripts by up-and-coming writers or people who are trying to find their first book, you really realize how often people don't realize what their best poem is. And, you know, this can last to your 10th book, of course. But it's fascinating how we have that blind spot sometimes. Like, we don't even know what we're doing or why.
Absolutely.
Maybe this is all of human existence. But especially with a poem, you strike gold and then you're looking around in the river still. And you're like, you know what? Actually, this is the poem. You have missed
completely agree.
It.
My most recent poem, The New Yorker, a few months ago, which you, Kevin, selected, is a poem that I wrote a few years ago, and the first time I read it, people were just like, that poem is amazing. I'm like, is it? I thought it was just one of the
music.
Five poems I was reading. I didn't give it any special attention.
Right.
But people loved it, you know, and I guess it's a poem really built to be heard aloud in a way.
Yeah, there's that part too. But
it elevated it in my own sense. I was like, oh, that's a good poem. I need to, like, attend to that, and I hadn't been.
Yeah. Well, and I think attending to one's music is the larger point here.
Yeah, it's quite true. It's quite true.
Camel, thank you so much for chatting with us today.
Oh, it has been a great pleasure.
The Human Heart by Camel McGrath, as well as Czeslaw Milosz's Realism, can be found on NewYorker.com. Czeslaw Milosz's new and collected poems, 1931-2001, was republished in 2017. Campbell McGrath's latest book is Nouns and Verbs.
You may subscribe to this podcast, the Fiction Podcast, the Writer's Voice Podcast, and the Politics and More Podcast by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. You can hear more poetry read by the authors on NewYorker.com and on the New Yorker app, available from the App Store or from Google Play. The theme music is The Corner, by Christian Scott Atunde Ajua, courtesy of Stretch Music and Rope-A-Dope. The New Yorker Poetry Podcast is produced by Jill Duboff of NewYorker.com with help from Hannah Eisenman.